Information is free.
The law.
There is hope.
When ignorance is converted into knowledge.
Tonight, we care.
To border and it shows.
The law.
The country.
You will remember nothing you have seen or heard here.
Whether he went on with the diary, or whether he did not go on with it, made no difference. The thought police would get him just the same.
From 9/11 cover-ups to economic stimulus, our silence cannot be bought. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to episode 112 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's February 20th, 2009. My name is James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, coming to you from the Portland Radio Authority and the Revere Radio Network. This week, urban guerrillas, citizen journalists, and falling debris, Betty Eckert and another 9/11 tragedy, American gangsters in the Afghan surge, hoarding scotch, jailing judges, shady deals, the greatest depression, Lusitania truth, and Geronimo versus Skull and Bones. It's all here. It's February 20th, 2009. It's episode 112 of MediaMonarchy.com.
I'm
Bourbon Gorilla. Brand new music from the fantastic band known as Primal Scream. Their new record is optimistically titled Beautiful Future. And we're hoping so here on episode 112 of MediaMonarchy.com. Let me welcome you, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, to the greatest show on earth. News, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. It's February 20th, 2009. Like I said, my name is James Evan Pilato, host and webmaster of the site and show, blasting out to you live, as always, every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific time on the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and now simulcasting live from the East Coast, but worldwide, baby. 1 p.m. on the East Coast, thanks to revereradionetwork.com, and of course, KBFR 93.9, Boulder Free Radio. I listened to a little bit a few nights ago. You guys are doing good work. Listen to a guy named Pistachio play nasty double entendre songs that were fantastic. They were literally some of the dirtiest songs I'd ever heard, and they were from the 40s and 50s. You can, of course, make contact with me on FaceSpace and YouTube and Yahoo and IM and Skype and iTunes and RadioForAll.net and Archive.org and even now Twitter.com. I'm going to try and post some updates, perhaps when I'm at work, looking at the news, looking at newspapers. And again, let me tell you about the shirt, the MediaMonarchy.com shirt, American Apparel, made in America. It's on Cafe Press. I get a buck if you buy one. A couple of other pieces of business or things of note. I had the fantastic opportunity yesterday to talk with my man James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It's amazing to hit a couple buttons and have a real-time conversation with someone in Japan over the computer. James had contacted me a week or so ago about being a guest or interviewed for an upcoming episode of Corbett Report about the new media. So he came to the Monarchy. We had a good time. I believe that's going to be on the next episode of Corbett Report, number 75, coming out this Sunday. So keep an eye out for that. I, of course, will probably post a link up to it as the shameless self-promoter that I am. And I, of course, hope soon to have James Corbett on Media Monarchy when we talk about his forthcoming, upcoming, parts are already out, it's still in progress, documentary called Al-Qaeda Doesn't Exist. Something else to mention in the interwebby world of social networking sites. Of course, we hit last night on the B-side of episode 111. Facebook membership may be forever. And that's, of course, the big brouhaha all this week about Facebook and the shock and surprise at their terms of service, which, of course, we shouldn't be. We know that we willingly give so much of our info away, and all you have to do is scroll to the bottom and see that it says, notice, we collect personal information on this site. But they couldn't handle the heat, and they backtracked and changed the terms of services back to, if you delete your account, they can't use your shit anymore. But through Facebook, I've made contact with a lot of people that I was never friends with on MySpace, actual friends and acquaintances and people I know going back to public school, middle school and high school. So I know with the feeds that I post to Facebook, all the headlines for MediaMonarchy.com go up on my Facebook wall. And I don't shove them in people's faces, but I know they're nice little truth bombs, little seeds being thrown out, being planted. So, a guy that I don't know all that well from high school, but I know him. Small town. I believe I'd said, as you can tell, I'm a little still stuffed up. So, sorry. I posted something and said, oh, you know, James M. Plato's laying in bed fighting a cold. And someone wrote, do you think the Illuminati infected you during a bioterror drill? Or at least that's how I took the tone of it to be. So I wasn't sure how to react, and I basically put, no, do you? And they said, no, but the germs will probably win at the end, and I know that media monarchy is scaring the hell out of me. So I thought he was fucking with me, calling me a conspiracy nut, which maybe he was in a little way, but I was able to defuse it, and if he says media monarchy's scaring the hell out of him, then I'm doing something right. And then yesterday, someone I know much better hit me up with a chat and said, boy, you really have gone way into the conspiracy stuff since you moved out west. Is that what the West does to people? And I didn't get to really talk about it much because he said, well, I got to go play Xbox. Who's the nut? But I love you guys. I'm not trying to make you angry. I hope you are listening to the show, and I hope you are exploring the site, and I hope you can help me put all the pieces together of this insane world. News, politics, conspiracies, and cover-ups. It's all here on episode 112 of MediaMonarchy.com. Not long after I talked to James Corbett yesterday, I got an email from my man Spencer Thayer, one of the guys behind ChicagoCopWatch.org. He sent me a note saying a video of an incident he had captured on a Chicago bus that he had uploaded was basically going viral, and it understandably made him kind of nervous, and he asked me to just post it up and help spread the word, which I did, and added the note to the posting, ChicagoCopWatch.org goes national after capturing bus incident. I write that Spencer Thayer is a fellow brother-in-arms in the info war, and he's gained national attention for his video showing police misconduct on a Chicago transit bus. This is, on the scene, citizen journalism from ChicagoCopWatch.org. That should be commended. Raw Story has posted the story with a clip from local NBC affiliate in Chicago that covered the story, NBCChicago.com. Raw Replay writes, Chicago's Independent Police Review Authority is investigating a confrontation between a police officer and a bus passenger after video of the incident was posted on the internet, according to a report in the Chicago Tribune.
This video was shot around 10:15 last Friday night on the CTA's number 70 division bus. The video starts rolling after an officer approaches a passenger who repeatedly refused to pay his fare. The passenger doesn't get up, and the situation escalates.
Get on. Get on. Now! Get on! Walk your sit here.
The officer calls for backup, struggles with a passenger, and then appears to punch him.
He knocked his head against the window, and that he punched the offender.
Spencer Thayer was on that bus and shot the video.
It seemed like the officer was escalating the situation more than the suspect.
Thayer posted the video to ChicagoCopWatch.org, a website he co-founded 2 years ago.
We are a group of committed citizens who are interested in police accountability, and we feel that the only way to really keep the police accountable is by monitoring their behavior.
Thayer says he filed a complaint with police following the incident.
This stuff probably happens more frequently than we would be comfortable with. And the sad thing is that no one is there to videotape it.
But people like you are, my man, Spencer Thayer, gaining national attention after his video of an incident on a Chicago bus, was picked up from his site, ChicagoCopWatch.org. Now, admittedly, and I believe a comment I saw, basically said this could have been a whole hell of a lot worse. We've seen, you know, people being tasered when they're handcuffed and much, much worse. So someone said, ah, nice try, but
no dice. I'd say, fortunately, this isn't a worse situation. I would call this police misconduct, and you can watch the video for yourself. Some of the annotations are added to the YouTube clip, so you can see the officer's badge number. You can see the point when their heads banged against the window. But the Associated Press report from the Chicago Tribune: authorities say Chicago's Independent Police Review Authority is investigating a confrontation aboard a bus between a police officer and a passenger who allegedly refused to pay his fare. A video that surfaced on the internet shows an officer physically removing the man from the Chicago Transit Authority bus. On the video, the passenger appears to resist arrest by refusing to leave and later by appearing to physically rebuff the officer. The officer can be heard using profanity as he orders the passenger from the bus. Their confrontation escalates into a physical struggle after the passenger, later identified as 49-year-old Lorenzo Wiley of Chicago, refuses to get off. Wiley was charged with misdemeanor theft of services for not paying. Review Board spokesman Mark Payne said Wednesday the agency will obtain video of the incident from the CTA. The last note is that Spencer Thayer, behind ChicagoCopWatch.org, posted up, of course, the Chicago Police's code of conduct and the buses, and he cites it and sources it. So, big praise to Spencer Thayer. A strange note now that I wasn't sure exactly how to place this in the flow of the show. Try and, if I have time, have the ability, try and arrange the show in some sort of flowing order. But I just didn't know where to put the story about debris falling in Texas that could have been from the satellite collision. Did you hear about the satellite collision? Did you hear about the nuclear submarines bumping into each other in the Atlantic? UK and French nuclear submarines going bump in the night with their massive WMD payload. We went over, of course, that stuff last night on the B-side, and missing guns and missing computers. A lot of technological glitchery, clusterfuckery going on. So whether it was the Facebook thing or the digital switch that hundreds of television stations made anyway, or the possible, probable surveillance microphone and camera discovered in a digital conversion box. So again, all that's on the B-side. And we go over Conficker and Internet 2. A lot of strange technological things going on in the last week or so. Debris falling in Texas could be from satellite collision. This is from the Associated Press. The Federal Aviation Administration has received numerous reports of falling debris across Texas, which could be related to a recent satellite collision. Some of the callers around mid-morning Sunday reported what looked like a fireball in the sky. FAA spokesman Roland Herwig says officials suspect the debris could be related to the collision, but that has not been confirmed. We get an update from Wikinews. From Stratcom, the United States Military Strategic Command, that of course they say nothing to see here. U.S. military says fireballs spotted over Texas are not related to satellite collision. This is Monday, February 16th, the day after. The United States Military Strategic Command, STRATCOM, has said that the fireballs spotted over areas of Texas in the United States on Sunday, February 15th, are not related to the collision of a U.S. and Russian satellite in space. This according to spaceweather.com, and NASA says the object was a meteor. There's more from NASA. Again, the swirling around of NASA. We went over Clyde Lewis's Ground Zero Lounge episode From Change to Strange, where he takes on some of the questions and some of the memes that I emailed to him about Obama and NASA and the space race war. Continuing, there's no correlation between the debris from that collision and those reports of reentry, said Stratcom military spokeswoman Major Regina. It's a natural meteor, definitely, said Bill Cook, an astronomer at NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office. On Tuesday, February 10th, the American civil communications satellite Iridium 33 launched in 1997, and the defunct Russian military communications satellite Cosmos 2251, launched in 1993, collided over Siberia. On Friday, the 13th, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, issued an alert for falling debris from the satellites following reports of earthquakes and explosions, along with flashes in the sky in Jackson and Louisville, Kentucky. Makes me think of the band Explosions in the Sky, and they're from Texas. Then again on Sunday, calls to 911 began to come into Williamson County, Texas Sheriff's Office around 12:30 in the afternoon. Burning debris and fireballs were seen falling from the sky on parts of Austin, Houston, Waco, and San Antonio. The Wikinews article goes on and cites the Union of Concerned Scientists, who perhaps say that maybe the military and Stratcom doth protest too much. Some of the other links and some of the other updates. There is a video clip of a slowed down, it appears to be a CNN clip about something completely unrelated. It actually looks like they're videoing a marathon or something. And in the background, you see the streaks. So that video is there, and some of the updates and some of the other links go, again, to the Chicago Tribune, to Danger Room, NewScientist.com, and on and on. And now it gets worse. Two weeks ago, February 6th, we discussed on MediaMonarchy.com that the Obamasiah was meeting with 9/11 victims' families. And I held the small hope that pertinent, tough, difficult questions would be asked, like they have been for the previous 7.5 years. But they weren't. 1 week ago on MediaMonarchy.com, we covered the fallout from that meeting and the fact that the Jersey Girls, some of the Jersey Girls, Lori Van Auken and others, how impressed they were with Obama and how they had been, quote-unquote, allayed. And we looked up the word allayed. It basically meant pacified. So we wondered if the Jersey Girls had gone gaga over the Obamasiah. What I didn't know was that the night before, late on the 12th, early on the 13th, that the plane crash in Buffalo, New York, that killed 50 people, 49 on the plane, one on the ground, that not only among those who died, one, a human rights expert, and perhaps we'll go into that later, but one of the women who met with Obama, 9/11 widow and activist, Beverly Eckert, was killed in the crash in Buffalo, 1 week to the day after meeting with Obama and talking about Guantanamo, when they should have been talking about 9/11 truth. 9/11 widow and activist among the 50 killed in New York plane crash. So we'll pick up the first report from the Deutsche Press agency. Widow from 9/11 attacks among New York crash victims. A woman who had lost her husband in the 9/11 attacks on the World Trade Center was among those killed in the late Thursday air crash in New York State, her sister said early Friday, the 13th. We know that she was on that plane, Sue Bork was quoted by the Buffalo News as saying about her sister, Beverly Eckert. E-C-K-E-R-T. Beverly Eckert. The sister, Sue Bork, had been waiting at the Buffalo airport to pick her up when the Continental Airlines plane crashed some 10 kilometers away. And now she's with him, she added, referring to her sister's husband, who was among the some 3,000 killed in the twin airplane attacks on the World Trade Center towers. Eckert was a co-chairwoman of Voices of September 11th, a group pushing for a formal commission to investigate the intelligence failures before the attacks and a proper memorial to the victims. There are many links and there are many updates, and we're going to dive in to an op-ed piece that the late Beverly Eckert wrote over 5 years ago. And it's what I mentioned at the top of the show. My silence can't be bought. Beverly Eckert, 9/11 widow and activist, among those killed in New York plane crash.
One of the families, the family of Beverly Eckert, and this was a family that's been through tremendous pain already before.
On board Flight 3407, Beverly Eckert, a 9/11 widow who had already endured a tragedy of her own. Beverly Eckert's husband, Sean Rooney, died in one of the Twin Towers on 9/11. They were high school sweethearts. And Beverly was now on her way back to Buffalo to mark what would have been her husband's 58th birthday. It had also become tradition that she would hand out a scholarship in his name, and she was planning to give the award at the high school, Canisius High. She told ABC in 2004 it was a role she never wanted, but somehow embraced.
I didn't choose this role. I feel it chose me. It was fate that my husband was one of the 3,000 people killed that day. I owe my husband. I owe his memory to make something constructive of my life.
She'd been living in Connecticut in the home she and her husband once shared. Beverly Eckert had become a powerful voice for victims of 9/11 on intelligence failures and on a memorial. This was Eckert in 2005.
It's hard to turn around and see the hole in the skyline where my husband's building used to be, where he died. I don't want there to be any more widows like me. I don't think that I can come here again to the place where my husband died, and knowing that I failed him and that his government failed him again.
Now, as profound sadness settles on this family again, Beverly Eckert's sister told the Buffalo News, "We know she was on that plane, and now she's with him."
Unimaginable second blow for this family. The only comfort, obviously, that the two are now together in another place. And as you mentioned, Buffalo, a large city, but a small town feel. There's going to be a lot of people who are connected to folks who are on this flight.
Very much of this to contacting the families. And there's going to be another layer to this situation. And we'll be here. We'll try to find out everything that we can. David, thank you for that. You'll be here with us.
Late last night, the second shift at a hospital in Buffalo was told to stay where it was. There had been a plane crash. The hospital would need all hands on deck to care for the wounded as they came pouring through the doors. It was the same alert with the same hope that had doctors and nurses on standby throughout Manhattan on September 11, 2001. In a fourth story tonight, then as now, the doctors stood idle. The nurses waited in vain. Continental Airlines Flight 3407 crashed just outside Buffalo at about 10:20 last night. As a nurse told the Buffalo New York News, there were no souls to bring in. All 49 people on board and one more on the ground dead. All of them lives worth remembering, worth celebrating. But one of them was a life intertwined with the life of her nation. Beverly Eckert was flying to Buffalo because that's where she and her husband, her late husband, Sean Rooney, had met. She was flying to Buffalo to celebrate what would have been his 58th birthday. Sean Rooney died on September 11th, 2001, in the South Tower of the World Trade Center in Lower Manhattan, talking to his wife on his cell phone as he tried to get out. After his death, Beverly founded Voices of September 11th, appearing among other venues on this news hour in pursuit of her missions, proper memorials, commissions, protections against future failed intelligence. Just last week, she met with President Obama, with other 9/11 family members, and family of those killed by Al-Qaeda aboard the USS Cole in 2000. Today, President Obama recalled one of the things that gave her life meaning and drew a lesson from the painful circumstances of her death.
Tragic events such as these remind us of the fragility of life and the value of every single day. One person who understood that well was Beverly Eckert, who was on that flight and who I met with just a few days ago. You see, Beverly lost her husband on 9/11 and became a tireless advocate for those families whose lives were forever changed on that September day.
Nor was Mr. Obama alone in hearing the Voices of September 11th, championed by Beverly Eckert. The former junior senator from New York, now America's Secretary of State, also remembered her today as more than an advocate, more than a voice.
She was one of the principal champions of the idea of the creation of the 9/11 Commission. I will miss her, and I want to just publicly thank her for all she did in the midst of her own tragedy.
As you've doubtless heard, Flight 3407 struck the ground in Clarence Center, New York, 6 miles away from the plane's intended destination. Air traffic control lost contact with the flight minutes before the crash. No indication of anything out of the ordinary. No mayday call from the pilot nor crew. Landing gear in place. Flames engulfed the wreckage, the crash site, burning off the excess jet fuel. An eyewitness reported hearing a loud boom, followed by several more explosions. It went on for 10 minutes. The NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board, today retrieving 3407's black boxes to determine why. Reporting this afternoon that other flights in the area experienced significant ice buildup, and the crew inside that flight was talking about that as well. We don't know whether Beverly Eckert saw lower Manhattan one last time as she took off last night from the same Newark airport that was the departure point of United Flight 93 on September 11th, 2001. We do know that she died in the course of pursuing her mission, that we not forget those 3,000. And we knew well before 10:20 p.m. last night that none of us could forget her.
Beverly Eckert, 9/11 widow and activist. There's, of course, more video and more interviews. There's eerie audio that ABC News goes through as you hear no response from that aircraft. And I don't want to think that there's anything suspicious about this. As I've said, the meme has been back out there of planes crashing in New York. But one from Paul Joseph Watson mentions a 9/11 cover-up connection, and of course this is the second time in as many weeks that other events have shed light on the events of 9/11. We of course had the massive, massive towering inferno in China a week ago. Didn't collapse. Way worse than Building 7. You can kind of compare those two. But in this case, Continental Flight 3407. The black boxes were found 15 hours after the Buffalo crash, which, of course, check it out, don't have the black boxes from 9/11. Or if they do, where are they? Can we maybe hear some of that stuff? They found DNA particles to supposedly be able to identify even the terrorists. But they couldn't find the super strong titanium meant to last through anything black boxes. And of course, just 7 days before her death, Beverly Eckert and other 9/11 victims' family members met with Barack Obama. Flashback links for you to both those stories on MediaMonarchy.com. Another one from the Deutsche Press Agency, recovery of bodies from plane crash that killed 50 to take days. Glenn Beck praises Beverly Eckert, 9/11 widow, but he did profess hatred for the 9/11 families back in 2005. That's, of course, from thinkprogress.org. A nice piece and a nice link from 9/11 blogger to Democracy Now! For an interview with Beverly Eckert on Democracy Now! And an update. The last update I have posted for this story was that the plane was on autopilot in the crash. Again, from the Deutsche Press Agency. Amidst recovery efforts for the remains of 50 victims of an icy New York airplane crash, investigators Sunday said the aircraft was on autopilot, a violation of suggested guidelines when icing on the wings is a danger, but in keeping with legal requirements. Steve Chelander, spokesman for the NTSB, described in broadcast remarks the sickening pitch and roll of Continental Express Flight 3407 in its last 26 seconds before it crashed into a house outside Buffalo, New York. The information was gleaned from the flight data recorder recovered from the wreckage. And if we jump down, we quote from Chelander, the flight manual for the Dash 8 Q400 craft advises that the autopilot be disengaged during severe icing conditions. What we've seen thus far has not indicated it was severe icing. Was it icy? Was it not? Was it autopilot? Was it not? I don't have time to speculate. But I want to read quickly from an op-ed from Beverly Eckert from December 19th, 2003. My silence cannot be bought. I've chosen to go to court rather than accept a payoff from the 9/11 Victims Compensation Fund. Instead, I want to know what went so wrong with our intelligence and security systems that a band of religious fanatics was able to turn four U.S. passenger jets into an enemy force, attack our cities, kill 3,000 civilians with terrifying ease. I want to know why two 110-story skyscrapers collapsed in less than 2 hours and why escape and rescue options were so limited. I'm suing because, unlike other investigative avenues, including congressional hearings and the 9/11 Commission, my lawsuit requires all testimony be given under oath and fully uses powers to compel evidence. The Victims Fund was not created in a spirit of compassion. Rather, it was a tacit acknowledgement by Congress that it tampered with our civil justice system in an unprecedented way. Lawmakers capped the liability of the airlines at the behest of lobbyists who descended on Washington while the fires still smoldered. And this liability cap protects not just the airlines, but also World Trade Center builders, safety engineers, and other defendants. The caps on liability have consequences for those who want to sue to shed light on the mistakes of 9/11. It means the playing field is tilted steeply in favor of those who need to be held accountable. With financial consequences other than insurance proceeds removed, there's no incentive for those whose negligence contributed to the death toll to acknowledge their failings or implement reforms. They can afford to deny culpability and play a waiting game. By suing, I forfeited the $1.8 million average award for a death claim I could have collected under the fund, nor do I have any illusions about winning money in my suit. What I do know is I owe it to my husband, whose death I believe could have been avoided, to see that all of those responsible are held accountable. If we don't get answers to what went wrong, there will be a next time, and instead of 3,000 dead, it'll be 10,000. What will Congress do then? So I say to Congress, big business, and everyone who conspired to divert attention from government and private sector failures, my husband's life was priceless, and I will not let his death be meaningless. My silence cannot be bought. Beverly Eckert died late February 12, 2009, on Continental Flight 3407 outside Buffalo, New York. And now we shift to American gangsters in the Afghan surge. That's right. We know, we knew all along that Obama wasn't going to end the war. He was just going to redistribute the cannon fodder. And I'm sorry, war's built on lies. More troops to guard Afghan heroin that props up banks. That's my headline for you. That's the catch-all umbrella for all of this. Afghanistan. And, of course, the amazing intersection of the three things that run the world. It's God. Think of it as a sort of unholy trinity. God, G-O-D, gold, oil, drugs. And as we go through here in some of the articles we're going to hit, they use terms like theater and enablers. You know, they use the term theater as a stage of operations in military speak. So when you see terms like theater and enablers, should really drop the curtain on what's really going on here. This is all about the drugs.
Why don't y'all take a look at that sign up there? See what it says? Cash for your home? You know what that is? What are y'all, Amos and Andy? You stepping and he's fetching? I'm talking about the message, what it stands for. It's called gentrification. It's what happens when the property value of a certain area is brought down. Huh? You listening?
Yeah.
To bring the property value down. They can buy the land at a lower price. Then they move all the people out, raise the property value, and sell it at a profit.
Now, what we need to do is we need to keep everything in our neighborhood, everything, black. Black-owned with black money. Just like the Jews, the Italians, the Mexicans, and the Koreans do.
Ain't nobody from outside bringing down the property value. It's these folks shooting each other and selling that crack rock and shit.
Well, how you think the crack rock gets into the country? We don't own any planes. We don't own no ships. We are not the people who are flying and floating that shit in here. I know every time you turn on the TV, that's what you see, black people selling the rock, pushing the rock, pushing the rock. Yeah, I know. But that wasn't a problem as long as it was here. It wasn't a problem until it was in Iowa, and it showed up on Wall Street where there are hardly any black people. Now, if you want to talk about guns, why is it that there's a gun shop on almost every corner in this community?
Why?
I'll tell you why. For the same reason that there's a liquor store on almost every corner in the black community. Why? They want us to kill ourselves. You go out to Beverly Hills, you don't see that shit.
I'm not guilty. You're the one who's guilty. Lawmakers, the politicians, the Colombian drug lords, all you who lobby against making drugs legal, just like you did with alcohol during the prohibition, you're the one who's guilty. I mean, come on, let's check the ballistics here. Ain't no Uzis made in Harlem. I mean, not one of us in here owns a poppy field. This thing is bigger than Nino Brown. This is big business. This is the American way.
You've heard that clip before, right? At the beginning, or rather the end, of Peruvian Cocaine by Immortal Technique. And that's, of course, Wesley Snipes on trial in the film New Jack City. Kicking the ballistics. Then, of course, we don't own Uzis, or rather make Uzis or own poppy fields. Where's this shit coming from? You heard Lawrence Fishburne in the clip before that. Boys in the Hood. This is all about the drugs. And I'm sure a little gold and oil as well. But you can watch both those clips from Boys in the Hood and from New Jack City. There's also a link to Kevin Booth's fantastic documentary, American Drug War. There's also a link to an amazing article from Mike Rupert on FromTheWilderness.com about the CIA and running drugs and Wall Street. We've also got the report from 1999 about Richard Grasso meeting with the FARC and telling them to invest their drug money in Wall Street. And finally, from historycommons.org, all of their entries on drug running and heroin and Afghanistan and opium and the Taliban. But let's jump back a little bit. Let's hit Time Magazine. Afghanistan became President Obama's war on Tuesday, February 17th, when he ordered two more U.S. combat brigades into the fight. He will send 17,000 combat troops to join the 36,000-strong U.S. force already in the theater. The fact that the units now ordered to Afghanistan had originally been slated for Iraq underscores the new administration's shift in priorities. The reinforcements include about 8,000 Marines from Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, who should be in Afghanistan by late spring, and a 4,000-strong Army brigade from Fort Lewis, Washington, which should arrive in the summer. Those units will be joined by about 5,000 more Army enablers to provide logistical support. Links in there to read about enablers and to read about theater in warfare. More from Danger Room, more from the Associated Press and Military.com. As always, fantastic reporting elsewhere. Russia Today, Obama and the Afghan Surge.
Restoring peace or waging a new war? Washington has chosen a new strategy in Afghanistan.
I am absolutely convinced that you cannot solve the problem of Afghanistan, the Taliban, the spread of extremism in that region solely through military means. We're going to have to use diplomacy. We're going to have to use development.
In order to secure success, Obama is now sending 17,000 troops to join those already on the ground. Some experts say Washington is copying the Soviet mistakes.
We've been there, done that. There will be an increase of forces. There will be an increase in fighting. There will be an increase of casualties. casualties on both sides. It will be for the benefit of those forces who want to destabilize the region.
In 1979, the Soviet Union launched a military campaign in Afghanistan to support the pro-Soviet government and protect its own influence in the region.
The Taliban is the notorious product of the adversaries of the Soviets during the Cold War. There were American financial flows that supported radical Islamic movements like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
The Soviets withdrew after almost a decade of fighting, but it failed to bring peace to the region torn apart by radical Islamists. Today, the US and its NATO allies are fighting the same foes Soviet soldiers were facing. Alexander Chubarov is a veteran of the Soviet-Afghan War. One of the challenges, he says, was to separate the locals from the insurgents.
During the day, they were peasants. And when the night came, they took their Kalashnikovs.
Now, just as 20 years ago, he says the use of force is not the solution.
To help the Afghan people to restore the economy. Because without their help, there wouldn't be a victory in this war.
The Soviet troops failed to get the situation under control. After 8 years of NATO's military campaign in Afghanistan, it appears the Soviet lesson remains unlearned. Alexander Kasharnika, RT.
The Afghan surge. Change. I can't fucking believe it. You thought the war was going to end. You thought Obama was going to be a savior. But you were too caught up in the phony grassroots hoopla, foundation-funded postmodern coup has taken place. Another one from Raw Story. I'm not going to play. It's the full interview of the Obamasiah with the CBC's chief correspondent, Peter Mansbridge, on the war in Afghanistan, where Obama says that Afghanistan is still winnable. Whatever that means. And, of course, the Russia Today report we just heard referencing the Soviets in Afghanistan, of course, egged on, provocateured to enter the country by Brzezinski. Admitted by Brzezinski. The specter behind the Wall Street bankster foundation puppet of Barack Obama. So if you don't see the connection between all of this and the drugs and Afghanistan and Brzezinski, you need to hit more links. One from Cryptagon, the invisible hand of the market. British troops have seized 50 million pounds. That's British pounds. That's money. Moolah. Drug money. Afghan opium. But a report I heard on the BBC, I didn't find the audio report, but the article is linked up from the BBC. Two-thirds of Afghan police are hooked on drugs. 60% of the Afghan police in the country's southern province of Helmand, H-E-L-M-A-N-D, use drugs. The estimate made by a UK official working in the province was contained in emails obtained by the BBC, the Big Brother Corporation. International forces are fighting a fierce counterinsurgency campaign against Taliban militants and other insurgents in Helmand, but British officials are clearly worried about the reliability of the Afghan police. We're very concerned by the levels of drug abuse among the police, is a quote from the British Foreign Office. Links in there to also the Telegraph and to also read more about the Helmand province. And, you know, just Google drugs, Afghan police. Back in the homeland from McClatchy. Big fans of MediaMonarchy.com, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, they have 106 of their own planes. So why did they charter a private jet, for one of their chiefs? If you read the article, it's because of a non-specific threat assessment. They might get blown up. Of course, the DEA recently kicked out of Bolivia because their president, Evo Morales, said they contribute to the drug running, which we know, which has been proven, which is what this is all about. Peter Dale Scott, Michael Rupert, Alfred McCoy, all these authors have all gone through the politics of heroin, the deep politics of gold, oil, and drugs, drug money, Wall Street, opium, heroin, Afghanistan, CIA, Iran-Contra. That's what you'll read about if you go to historycommons.org. You'll read about heroin and the CIA and Iran-Contra and drugs for arms, for money, for God knows what. But we'll wrap this up about troops, you know, guarding that Afghan heroin that props up our failing banks. If you pull the drug money from our banks, destitution. BusinessInsider.com asks the question, how much of our debt comes from drug money? Alan Stanford, which if you can read about right now is in the news for more chicanery. Alan Stanford forfeited $3 million in drug money back in 1999 when he was first getting in trouble, I believe. And it's a sure thing that within his multi-billion dollar empire, he had many more drug dollars under his care. This is true not just of Alan Stanford, but of the whole Caribbean offshore banking complex. As drug dealers are obviously interested in the regulation light, few questions asked, private banking system. Offshore banks, meanwhile, have grown rapidly as major purchasers of U.S. treasuries over the years. As you can see in the charts and in the graphs that are posted up and linked up in this story, how much of our debt comes from drug money. The spike happened in 04 and 05, right as Japanese holdings leveled off, and according to another chart and graph and table, Caribbean banks are now the fourth biggest holders of treasuries, having surpassed Brazil and all of the oil states combined in just the last year. So again, taking all of this into account, and I haven't even done it justice, all the links are there, all the research is there for you. Read Dark Alliance. Watch American Drug War. But let's break it down, and let's, again, kick the ballistics and ask again, how much drug money goes into financing our debt? And if you doubt the basic premise of this question, here's KRS-One making basically the same point in Illegal Business.
Cocaine business controls America. Ganja business controls America. KRS-One comes to start some hysteria. Illegal business controls America. Cold. He was standing on the block, selling Chiba, mixing dimes, saying a rhyme just to pass the time. The cops passed by, but he stayed calm, cause the leather trench coat was keeping him warm. But this time they walked by real slowly. He thought to himself, they look like they know me. They drove away, but he didn't stay. He jumped in the cab and he paid his tab. But guess who he saw when he hit the block? It was the same cop car, the same two cops. They jumped out quick. They said, don't try to fight and don't try to run. Cooperate and we will be your friend. Non-cooperation will be your end. He jumped in the car and while they rode, they ran down the list of things he owed. They said, you owe us some money, you owe us some product, cause you could be right in the river tied up. He thought for a second and he said, what is this? You want me to pay you to stay in business? They said, that's right, or you go to prison. Cause nobody out there is really gonna listen to a hood. So he said, good, I'll pay you off for the whole neighborhood. Because cocaine business controls America. Ganja business controls America. KRS-One comes to start some hysteria. Illegal business controls America.
What can we hear for 63 cents? What want him back. He sells at work, he sells in schools. He's not stupid, the cops are the fools. Cause everyone else seems to go to jail. But when it comes to Jack, the cops just fail. They can't arrest him, they cannot stop him. Cause even in jail, the bail unlocks him. So here is the deal, and here is the facts. If you ever wonder why they can't stop crack, the police department is like a crew that does whatever they want to do. In society, you have illegal and legal. We need both to make things equal. So legal is tobacco, illegal is speed. Legal is aspirin, illegal is weed. Crack is illegal because they cannot stop you. But cocaine is legal if it's owned by a doctor. Everything you do in private is illegal. Everything's legal if the government can see you. Don't get me wrong, America is a great place to live. But listen to the knowledge I give. Cocaine business controls America. Ganja business controls America. KRS-One comes to start some hysteria. Illegal business controls America. Illegal business controls America.
What can we get for 63 cents?
Illegal business controls America.
What can we get for 63 cents?
Illegal business controls America.
What can we get for 63 cents?
KRS-One comes to start some hysteria.
One of the smartest artists of the last 20 plus years, KRS-One in Boogie Down Productions, Illegal Business. Cocaine business controls America. And again, thanks to BusinessInsider.com. They're the one that posted that video up at the end of their article about drugs and finances and Wall Street, that it's basically broken down perfectly in a song from many, many years ago. And of course, KRS-One, 9/11 truther. We're hitting on hour number two of this 112th episode of MediaMonarchy.com. It's February 20th, 2009. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com, the site and the show. Blasting out live from the Portland Radio Authority, praradio.org, and the Revere Radio Network, revereradio.net. And again, thanks to 93.9 Boulder Free Radio. Yeah, it's time now for more on the Obamasiah and all his updates and all his Bilderbergers, Brzezinskis, and billions. A quick headline from EastValleyTribune.com. Not sure where this is from. A local report about students questioning Obama. So we note that maybe there's still some hope, actually. The story basically goes into kids in high school with some Obama speech on the screen and people not really interested in texting and writing notes and dozing off. And when asked about Obama, they all basically, he's just saying a bunch of junk. Now if we can get them to look behind all that junk. If they're realizing now, of course, that this is a put-up job. He's a puppet. So maybe there's still hope. Students questioning Obama. But the criminal cabinet grows and grows. Obama picks Bilderberger Sebelius for health secretary. Obama's picked a Bilderberger to be his choice for health secretary, Kansas Governor Kathleen Sebelius, S-E-B-E-L-I-U-S, Sebelius. She was bandied about as a possible VP. But of course, Obama initially picked former Senate Democrat leader Tom Daschle, the senator from Citibank. But of course, Daschle had to withdraw because of personal tax issues. And he's not the first, and he won't be the last. And as we get close to tax time here in America, and as things start to crumble, and as talk of a possible tax revolt starts to grow, you have to ask yourself why all these guys get in trouble for tax problems. Could it be because they know it's all a bunch of bullshit? But in other words, he didn't bother to pay any taxes because minions of the elite are not required to do so except for public relations reasons. Recall that Kathleen Sebelius, described as a moderate Democrat, was considered a leading candidate to be Obama's vice presidential running mate last summer, but the elite picked CFR member Joe Biden instead. In June 08, Sebelius attended the 2008 Bilderberg meeting in Chantilly, Virginia, a fact not reported by the corporate media in her home state of Kansas. But she was, of course, included on the official 2008 Bilderberg participant list, which is linked up for you. And if you'll recall, and if you hit the flashback back to June of 2008, Bilderberg, a shadow super government, and also the Bilderberg blowout, another cover-up exposed also from June, was when the light shone upon the Bilderberg globalist elite meeting. They couldn't hide anymore. They have to issue a press release. They had never done that before in 50-plus years. So add Sebelius to the criminal cabinet. She's health secretary. I'm going to start wearing a surgical mask. A quick headline from Raw Story is that Obama, not Bush, is seeking a delay of Karl Rove's deposition. You starting to get it? One from Kurt Nimmo, and I didn't have time to edit the clip, so I don't have it for you. However, not hearing Zbigniew Brzezinski talk isn't the worst thing in the world. But from Kurt Nimmo, Brzezinski's fear is class warfare and destruction of the New World Order. Making an appearance on the Morning Joe television show, the Rockefeller globalist Zbigniew Brzezinski said it is high time the rich who have made billions since the days of the Clinton administration help out the poor and struggling masses. Said Brzezinski, quote, "Where is the moneyed class today? Why aren't they doing something? The people who'd made billions, millions. I'm sort of thinking of Paulson, of Rubin. Why don't they get together and why don't they organize a national solidarity fund in which they call on all those who have made these extraordinary amounts of money to kick some back to a national solidarity fund?" Brzezinski almost looked grandfatherly as he said this, and of course, you can watch the whole video. He almost came off as a good-natured humanitarian, almost. And it all sounded good, if implausible, that is, until Brzezinski reached the end of his carefully crafted diatribe, saying, quote, "And if we don't get some sort of voluntary national solidarity fund, at some point there'll be such political pressure that Congress will start getting into the act, there's going to be growing conflict between the classes, and if people are unemployed and really hurting, hell, there could even be riots." In other words, Brzezinski's afraid that if some filthy lucre isn't dispensed among the unwashed masses, they'll rise up, burn down the banks, sack the corporations, and destroy the globalist edifice so painfully erected over the last 50 years or so. And maybe even going so far as to string up Brzezinski and his fellow globalists from trees and overpasses, the sort of dirty and regrettable business that invariably occurs in the process of violent revolutions in response to decades of provocation. We do not want that here. But we note, of course, the fall of Ceausescu. We'll have to go over that sometime. I need to study it more myself. So when suddenly everybody realizes, hey, you're fed up as shit too? Let's go in this now. And they do. The new Homeland Stupidity director, Janet Napolitano, has ordered a review of Homeland Security. And if you read the article I have linked up from Newsmax, I believe I saw it from McClatchy and other places, they note they need to work more on their terror drills. So we'll be watching that. More problems, more ethics problems, more tax problems, more from Rambo Emanuel. This from the New York Post. News broke last week that Rahm Emanuel, now White House Chief of Staff, lived rent-free for years in the home of Representative Rosa DeLauro, Democrat from Connecticut, and failed to disclose the gift as congressional ethics rules mandate. But this is only the tip of Emanuel's previously undisclosed ethics problems. One issue is the work Emanuel tossed the way of DeLauro's husband. But the bigger one goes back to Emanuel's days on the board of now bankrupt mortgage giant Freddie Mac. Rahm Emanuel is a multimillionaire, but lived for the last 5 years for free in the Tony Capitol Hill townhouse owned by DeLauro and her husband, Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg. We'll have to see if he's related to Hank and AIG. Now Rahm Emanuel is in the White House helping Obama dig out the mess that Freddie Mac helped start. The president's chief of staff isn't subject to Senate confirmation, but his ethics still matter. Is this the change that we can depend on? Obama and the media dilemma is, I believe, from Robert Perry on ConsortiumNews.com discussing the possible return of the so-called fairness doctrine. But let's have a little bit more about Rahm Emanuel, former Israeli army soldier, army man. But it's a family affair. Dr. Ezekiel Emanuel, Rahm's brother, has been tapped for healthcare policy advisor spot. Now, this obviously before Sebelius was appointed health czar. The Chicago Sun-Times writes, while the Obama White House is searching for a replacement for Daschle, policy work on health care reform, a priority for the administration, is ongoing, with one key advisor especially well-connected, the brother of White House Chief of Staff Rahm Emanuel, Dr. Ezekiel J. Emanuel, a noted bioethicist, is advising the Obama administration on health care reform. Dr. Emanuel is the chair of the Department of Bioethics at the Clinical Center of the National Institutes of Health. Bioethicist. Coming soon to a state-run health plan near you. Leon Panetta is now the head of the CIA. We'll have to look more into that. However, from the Washington, or rather the Wall Street Journal, Obama pre-screens reporters at a press conference. About halfway through President Obama's press conference Monday night, he had an unscripted question of his own. "All Chuck Todd," the president said, referring to NBC's White House correspondent, "Where's Chuck?" He had the same strange question about Fox News' Major Garrett. Where's Major? The problem wasn't the lighting in the East Room. The president was running down a list of reporters pre-selected to ask questions. The White House had decided in advance who would be allowed to question the president and who was left out. Presidents are free to conduct press conferences however they like, but the decision to pre-select questioners is an odd one, especially for a White House famously pledged to openness. We doubt that President Bush, who was notorious for being parsimonious with follow-ups, would have gotten away with pre-screening his questioners, but Mr. Obama can more than handle his own, so our guess is that this is an attempt to discipline reporters who aren't White House favorites. Few accounts of Monday night's event even mention the curious fact that the White House had picked its speakers in advance. We hope that omission from the media wasn't out of being fear of being left out and left off the list next time. Pre-screening. pre-screening the media? Well, that kind of answers the media dilemma, or at least one small part of it. Lastly, on this, Obamasai updates posting Bilderberger, Brzezinski, and Billions, a few headlines that we don't have time to dive into, but they are, of course, linked there for you to check it out for yourself. Like whether or not Michelle Obama is flashing the devil sign on the cover of Vogue, a new book by Jonah Goldberg, who's not someone I would promote, but his new book, Liberal Fascism, pretty much calls out exactly what Webster Tarpley's been talking about, is that we're seeing fascism. If we look at Italy, Mussolini, he coined it. But again, more Democrats call for censoring talk radio. And in the spy case, Obama's Justice Department holds on state secrets privilege. So again, still hanging on to the rendition, still hanging on to the state secrets privilege, still hanging on. Obama's DOD appointees, the $3.4 trillion question, that's from Global Research. And then the stimulus plan. Debt owed to the bankers, not government socialism. Homeland Security gets infotech money in the stimulus bill. And of course, Obama signed this big phony $787 billion stimulus package in Denver. Home of the New World Airport. Possible deep underground military bases and God knows what else. A note on the military, and a note that we've hit time and time again. As things go downhill, the requirements get lowered. From the New York Times, U.S. military will offer path to citizenship for immigrants. Stretched thin in Afghanistan and Iraq, the American military will begin recruiting skilled immigrants who are living in this country with temporary visas, offering them the chance to become United States citizens in as little as 6 months. Immigrants who are permanent residents with documents commonly known as green cards have long been eligible to enlist, but the new effort, for the first time since the Vietnam War, will open the armed forces to temporary immigrants if they have lived in the U.S. for a minimum of 2 years. This according to military officials familiar with this new plan. Recruiters expect that the temporary immigrants will have more education, foreign language skills, and professional expertise than many Americans who enlist, helping the military to fill shortages in medical care, language interpretation, and field intelligence analysis. The American Army finds itself in a lot of different countries where cultural awareness is critical, said Lieutenant General Benjamin C. Freakley, the top recruitment officer for the Army, which is leading the pilot program. There will be some very talented folks in this group. And I'm sure there will. Links to the Globe and Mail, Economic Times, and India Times. But the flashbacks, to flesh this out, October 2006, allmediamonarchy.com, U.S. is recruiting misfits for Army. December 2006, military considers recruiting foreigners. February 2007, military accepting more ex-cons. And finally, December 2008, soldiers of misfortune recruiting kids to serve in the military. As things collapse, the jobs dry up. You start to get desperate as we move to the econo crash and our new financial world order. The econo crash is covering hoarding, seizing, drinking, and cashless, and this is really all starting to sound like a bad country song. Losing your job and hoarding scotch and taxes and Kansas income tax and John Williams, not the composer, But the economist at shadowstats.com says that maybe you should hoard some gold and some scotch.
Now, you actually reckon that now we've had all this stimulus, stimulus coming along, you foresee quite large inflation. Give me your outlook maybe 3-4 years out into the future.
3-4 years out into the future, I think we could be in a hyperinflation. Within the current year, you're going to see much higher inflation than most people are looking at. Double digit, as the government reports it, perhaps hyperinflation. What we're seeing is that money growth, which drives inflation, is beginning to pick up. So there's the velocity of money. And with the government owing $65 trillion in obligations, including unfunded liabilities on Social Security and such, no ability to pay that off by raising taxes, the government's headed towards a hyperinflation down the road. And with a hyperinflation, my definition of that would be along the lines of, if you look at the largest currency note in circulation, in this case a $100 bill, before the inflation, when that becomes worth more functional toilet paper, then you have a hyperinflation.
And now, what should investors do in a situation like that? Where should they put their money? Where should normal people put their money?
This is a time where you want to preserve your wealth and assets because inflation will not get the value out of it. Number one, and again, I'm talking long-term here because there's a lot of short-term volatility and things such as holding some physical gold, holding some assets outside the U.S. dollar, and then when a hyperinflation hits.
What about, you've also mentioned in the past, I think, that scotch might be a good idea.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, because when the hyperinflation hits, you'll see a disruption of normal commerce. You won't be able to have enough $100 bills to buy what you want. So that having items to barter, such as a bottle of scotch, if you're a scotch drinker, buy some cases of scotch. If I'm wrong, you can always consume them. But you have something there that you can barter with to get you through the rough time.
Drinking scotch at Armageddon. But hopping back to here in Oregon, outrage brewing in Oregon over proposed 1,900% beer tax increase. This from local KGW. Five Oregon state lawmakers want to impose a hefty tax on beer and have introduced a bill that brewers say would kill them. Four Portland legislators joined a Springfield senator to introduce Oregon House Bill 2461, with a PDF for you, which would impose a $49.61 tax on each barrel of beer produced by Oregon brewers. The tax would raise revenue for a state at a time when budgets are running in the red. Specifically, the bill says it would fund prevention, treatment, and recovery programs for those addicted to alcohol and other substances. A deal from Liberty Media staved off bankruptcy for Sirius Satellite Radio. That's from Breitbart.com. However, we're turning to Kansas. From the Wichita Eagle and Kansas.com, Kansas suspends income tax refunds. Income tax refunds and state employee paychecks could be late after Republican leaders and the Democratic governor clashed Monday over how to solve a cash flow problem. Payments to Medicaid providers and schools also could be delayed. Quote, "We're out of cash, in essence," said State Budget Director Dwayne Goosen. And of course, California is going broke. And dear God, I can't stop seemingly playing clips of Glenn Beck. Now, one of the videos I have on my YouTube channel, youtube.com/MediaMonarchy, where Glenn Beck talks about the New World Order endgame. And it has tens of thousands of views, shit tons of comments. It's the most commented video that I have. But here he is, again, saying what's coming. Depression and revolution.
If they how does someone in a depression scenario, let's just throw the scenario out. Let's say things get really bad.
Grapes of Wrath bad.
Dust Bowl bad. All right, I'm there. Hooverville bad.
Putting the depression in depression.
Here I am.
Okay, so you're there.
All right. Okay.
All right.
So here you are. How is it they're going to let people like you and me and everybody else, Rush, Sean, speak out against Obama?
Who's going to stop us?
the...
Oh, oh.
Is it just me?
Are the National Guard going to come to your house?
No,
I think you are going to have a gigantic split in this. All right, let's just play all the cards out of the table.
Go ahead.
I'm full-fledged crazy nuts. You know it and I know it. So here it is. This is what's coming, America. Depression and revolution. That's what's coming.
All right.
They're gonna eat rich. And they're starting with you.
Why am I putting this man on the air? Are you selling muskets now? I mean, do you have to go to Concord, Massachusetts?
Yes. He's got doormats. I've got muskets.
All
which
right.
one do you think is going to really come?
Power to the people. I'm going to nickname you Huey. It's not Glenn Beck anymore.
Is that what it is?
It's Huey Newton Beck. It's not Glenn Beck anymore.
See, I don't.
So, depression, revolution.
No, look. Hopefully none of that's going to happen.
Hopefully
that's not going to happen.
But you're preparing.
Now listen to me. No, I'm not building a militia. I'm just you see what he's doing? Look, here's the thing. You tell me how you continually disenfranchise people, push them up against the wall.
You know, look, if I hear any more of this, I'm going to commit suicide, Beck. All right? This is a happy show.
Glenn Beck, everybody. That's not my plan.
It's possible that Glenn Beck has really had his old shit moment. And in the best way he knows how, he's out there talking about the New World Order and trying to expose it and still keep his job. Or it's also possible he's a total stooge frontman who's using some of the rhetoric and some of the talking points that folks like myself would use so that we pay attention to Glenn Beck like we just did. Again from the BBC, an article from them shilling for a cashless society. Consumers in the UK, this is all about an anniversary of the check. Consumers in the UK should expect a revolution in the way they pay for things in the near future, according to Payments Association APACS, APACS. The check, which is 350 years old on February 16th, is said to be in irreversible decline as innovation points towards a cashless society. Banks will increasingly battle for a consumer to use one card exclusively. But as consumers prepare to pay and access accounts using their mobiles, retailers are worried costs will rise. Links in there to the BBC, again, to read about APACS, to read about the history of the check, and to watch videos and run searches and learn about a cashless society. Not to mention, you know, the commercials that show how uncool you are if you have cash, even though it's the quickest thing in the world. It's everything else that's slow. Banks in Florida, Illinois, Nebraska, and Oregon have been seized. That's from Bloomberg. However, from the Deutsche Press Agency, U.S. intelligence chief sees economic peril as major threat. The top U.S. intel official warned last Thursday that the global economic crisis has evolved into a major threat to U.S. interests in the world. Dennis Blair, CFR, Brookings Institute. Dennis Blair, Director of National Intelligence, told a Senate committee that the economic crisis threatens to destabilize governments in less developed countries friendly to the United States and could curtail NATO support for the conflict in Afghanistan. The primary near-term security concern of the United States is the global economic crisis and its geopolitical implications, Blair said. The crisis has been ongoing for over a year, and economists are divided on whether and when we could hit bottom. LoneStarTimes.com tells us about the militarization of our police departments with the stimulus and bailout money. Federalizing the police. Remember, the terror drills, the urban warfare, practicing to take over your cities. But moving to Pennsylvania and the Associated Press. Sad, disgusting story. Pennsylvania judges accused of jailing kids for cash.
Today, this office has filed a 2-count criminal information charging President Judge Mark A. Chivarella and former President Judge Michael T. Conahan.
I was locked up in a juvenile wilderness camp for 4 weeks.
They took custody of my daughter away from my husband and I, who wasn't even present
because she drew a funny picture of her principal. It didn't make any sense. The pieces didn't fit together. She'd never been in trouble before. She was a decent student. I told them at probation she was a good girl. I never have any problems. So I couldn't understand.
I was really mad. I was so insulted that, you know, I kind of have a reputation that was destroyed. You know, I came back to school and everyone was like, oh, she's been locked up. She's, you know, she's a bad kid or she's stupid, you know, and I felt so disgraced for a while. Like, you know, what do people think of me now?
I spent October 2004 until February of 2005 in Camp Adams. Now, basically, I find out, you know, that this guy was lining his pockets, by sending kids away to these detention centers. I know that I myself am just a small part of the millions of dollars that were paid to these judges, but it's still absolutely incredible. Like how can you actually put a price on all of these lies, all these kids?
We wonder why these kids don't trust these people. It's because, you know, who do they have to put faith in? And I think it's really disappointing that so many kids would end up getting stuck in a terrible situation because someone else wanted to make money off of them.
Two Pennsylvania county judges walked solemnly today into U.S. District Court in Scranton. These judges found themselves on the other side of the bench, pleading guilty to a brazen and profitable scheme. Mark Shivarella and Michael Conahan faced fraud and tax charges for allegedly taking $2.6 million in kickbacks, for sentencing thousands of juveniles to detention facilities run by two privately owned companies. Here's how prosecutors say it worked. Young offenders, often with no prior record, were brought before these judges for charges as minor as stealing change from cars or writing prank notes. The judges shipped them off to private detention facilities, which got county money to house them. In exchange, the judges allegedly received money for each offender. They also received payoffs for the initial construction and operation of these juvenile jails.
It's just really scary there.
15-year-old Bernadine Wallace was sentenced to a month in lockup for a threatening note she posted on her MySpace page.
After a while, I was just saying to myself, you know, I don't deserve this. I don't think that I did that much wrong. I mean, I'm not a criminal.
Civil rights attorneys say thousands may have had their rights violated.
Frequently, there were no lawyers. Frequently, you were told before you were found guilty, the sentence was going to be by the juvenile probation department, and you were whisked away.
You saw the judges come out of court today.
Yeah.
How are you feeling?
Angry.
Why?
How do they get to walk out with all these charges? When she went in front of them, she got taken out in shackles.
Attorneys for the judges refused to comment because a plea agreement has not been finalized. The judges could face at least 7 years in federal prison. Seth Doan, CBS News, Scranton, Pennsylvania.
We can only hope those guys would spend 7 years in prison. If you think for a moment, if something like that happened to you or someone in your family, I would fucking wig. If you found out your life was, if not ruined, irrevocably scarred, all for a scam. Prisons run for profit. Pisses me off, actually, just thinking about it. So let's keep moving on the econo crash. Hoarding, seizing, drinking, and cashless. Highest unemployment in 30 years. And the South Carolina governor says, in relation to all that's swirling around, is that we're basically moving close to a savior-based economy, which is all part of the plan. That video and that clip is there for you. And, of course, the economic rescue plan is more debt, devaluation, and bigger government. We also have Representative Ken Jorski talking about $550 billion disappearing in a, quote, electronic run on the banks. That video is there for you as well. Where we're going to keep speeding ahead as even the elderly are facing eviction. That's from the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, of course, recently put up for sale. Homeowner group protests predator CEOs outside their mansions. This is a good story, and again, one that is probably indicative of the shape of things to come. If these activists are as dedicated as they are desperate, expect this to become a trend. Monday, a group of 350 to 400 at-risk homeowners organized by the Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, NACA.com, staged a series of protests outside the mansions of wealthy bankers in a moneyed Connecticut neighborhood. Called the Predators Tour, these actions were the start of NACA's accountability campaign, an aggressive, confrontational protest aimed at several top executives of companies that refused to allow NACA to renegotiate the terms of loans on behalf of members. This all according to NACA, NACA, Neighborhood Assistance Corporation of America, CEO Bruce Marks, and reported by the StamfordTimes.com. Sporting bright yellow shirts that read, "Stop Loan Sharks," protesters demanded more accountability from the CEOs of the financial institutions responsible for the millions of unaffordable mortgages in the states and across America. In the state of, I believe in this case, where are we? Stamford? Are we in Connecticut? I don't even know where the hell we are. But more reports from NBCNewYork.com. Grab your torch and pitchfork. And again, it's funny to note the word mortgage. If you break it down, mort, death. You will pay until you die. The amazing article, and not in a good way, from Time Magazine, New World Order for the Economy, calling for it. Openly, it's in your face. Years ago, it didn't exist. Now it does, and it's good. And you're crazy if you don't like it. Others have gone into that in more detail. I'm going to have to keep moving. But another politician, a quick little clip. Again, thanks to businessandmedia.org. There are more shady deals going on behind closed doors.
My name is Tom Price. I represent the 6th District of Georgia and am privileged to chair the Republican Study Committee. It's now noon on Wednesday. We stand outside the office of the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. The corridor is closed. We've just heard news break that there's been an agreement between the House and the Senate on the non-stimulus bill. It's curious because Republicans were invited to a meeting that begins at 3 o'clock this afternoon. What this means is that there are more shady deals going on.
Tom Price was his name, as he said there. And again, that clip is available for you. Shady deals going on behind closed doors. And there were. And they, of course, reached and signed the stimulus bill. Perhaps we'll get more into that as I hold my breath and try and research a little bit of it. An article from Peter Schiff, who notes that this is just the beginning. And the last update on this econo crash posting, hoarding, seizing, drinking, and cashless. The Dow ended yesterday, Thursday, February 19th, at its lowest close in more than 6 years. An important psychological barrier gave way on Wall Street Thursday as the Dow Jones Industrials fell to their lowest levels in more than 6 years. The Dow broke through a bottom reached in November, pulled down by a steep drop in key financial shares. It was the lowest close for the Dow since October 9th, 2002, when the last bear market bottomed out. Another week, another record set of lowest ever, or lowest in decades. You know, I was wrong. I'm always saying here on the show that, you know, we don't make anything. We don't make shit here in America. And that's why, you know, they want to take stress off of using things like buy American. You know, we don't want to seem protectionist and isolationist in the global marketplace, especially at a time of economic turmoil. And of course, the banksters get all the money that they want in the bailouts, but the automakers have to beg for it, and others. But I was wrong. And this article from the Associated Press helps it and asks the question, does the United States make anything anymore? It may seem like the country that used to make everything is on the brink of making nothing. In January, 207,000 U.S. manufacturing jobs vanished in the largest one-month drop since October 1982. Factory activity is hovering at a 28-year low. Even before the recession, plants were hemorrhaging work to foreign competitors with cheap labor, and some companies were moving production overseas. But manufacturing in the United States isn't dead or even dying. It's moving upscale, following the biggest profits and becoming more efficient, just like Henry Ford did when he created the assembly line to make the Model T. The U.S. by far remains the world's leading manufacturer by value of goods produced. It hit a record $1.6 trillion in 2007, nearly double the $811 billion in 87. For every $1 of value produced in China's factories, America generates $2.50. So what's made in the USA these days? The U.S. sold more than $200 billion worth of... wait for it... aircraft, missiles, and space-related equipment in 2007 alone. $200 billion of aircraft, missiles, and space-related equipment. $80 billion is also from auto and auto parts. Deere & Company, best known for its bright green and yellow tractors, sold $16.5 billion worth of farming equipment last year, much of it to the rest of the world. Then there's energy products like gas turbines for power plants made by General Electric, computer chips from Intel, and fighter jets from Lockheed Martin, household names like General Electric, General Motors, International Business Machines, Boeing, Hewlett-Packard are among the largest manufacturers by revenue. So see, I was wrong. We do make stuff. I added some interesting links in there for you to read more about some of these high-end companies that are doing just great. And it's generally, usually, because they're tied in with the military-industrial entertainment complex. Boeing. And it was, of course, a Boeing that was sighted over Washington. The 9/11 mystery aircraft was the Boeing Doomsday plane. International Business Machines, the solutions company, of course, the final solutions company, with their punch card Hollerith devices, helping the Nazis and their eradication in concentration camps. Fully administered and helped along by the amazing people at IBM. General Motors, General Electric, all those links are in there for you. More to historycommons.org. And even Henry Ford, of course, Nazi profiteer. Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, Anthony Summers. It's all connected. It's all a big happy family. And again, more bad news, everyone. But more good reporting from Russia today and more scary news from Gerald Celente. TrendsResearch.com. We've, of course, heard from Gerald Celente back in January 2008. Futurist foresees rough times. And of course, just in this last December, Greece-style riots coming to the U.S. Those are the flashbacks first for MediaMonarchy.com. Because right now, Gerald Celente and Russia Today, in 2009, we're going to see the worst economic collapse ever. The greatest depression, says Gerald Celente, U.S. Trends forecaster. He believes it's going to be very violent in the U.S., including there being a tax revolt. Gerald Celente, Russia Today, we're going to see the greatest depression ever.
The fragile U.S. economy has been met with bank bailouts and stimulus plans. So what's to come in 2009? Joining me now to answer that question is Gerald Celente, founder and director of the Trends Research Institute. Thank you for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
How would you define the economic trend that you have forecasted for 2009?
We're going to see an economic collapse, the likes of which the world has never seen before. It's not only in the United States, it's going global. At the end of 2008, we saw Christmas sales, retail sales. Women's apparel down 23%. Home furnishings and electronics off 27%. Luxury items down 35%. These are Depression-era collapses. We saw major bankruptcies. Circuit City. We saw millions of things. One bankruptcy after another. Then we saw store closings. Starbucks, Home Depot. Down the line, the question becomes, who is going to take all of the vacant retail space? Who is going to rent it? The answer is nobody. Now we look at the financial collapse in 2008. You saw the Merrill Lynch mob go under, the Bear Stearns gang go out of business, the Lehman Boys, they went bankrupt. You saw bond companies, brokerage firms, banks go belly up or bought out. Who's going to rent all the vacant commercial business space that they used to occupy? The answer is nobody. Commercial real estate collapse that's going to happen in 2009 is going to dwarf the residential real estate collapse.
You use the Great Depression as an analogy, as a comparison. During the Great Depression, unemployment was at 25%. Now with housing increased, it's at, I think, over 7.2. Is that number going to get much, much bigger?
We have to look at the real number. There's two sets of books the government keeps. When they measure up unemployment, they don't add in the people who are no longer looking for jobs because they've become discouraged and can't find any after looking so long. And they don't include part-time workers. When you put that number into it, the number is 13.7%. And that's a government number. And this is just beginning. And again, current events form future trends. What did we see? We saw in one day 61,000 jobs evaporate off the map. You're going to see Great Depression numbers. Because as I'm mentioning, with this real estate, commercial real estate collapse, all of these retail stores closing, Starbucks, Macy's, you go down the line, you look at not only the people that work for these places that no longer have jobs, but how about all the support industries, the advertising, the manufacturers of products that are going to be laying off people as well. We're going to see Great Depression numbers. And matter of fact, this is going to be worse than the Great Depression.
What are we going to see happening to the society, to people's day-to-day lives in terms of how they treat one another, how they behave, crime?
When I say it's going to be worse than the Great Depression, we call this the Greatest Depression. And by the way, to be using 1930s models to get us out of this is really stupid. Back then, when we first crashed, most people didn't own homes. There was no such thing as a home equity loan. And back then, people didn't have credit cards. The consumer wasn't $14 trillion. We had a manufacturing base that built the world out of the Great Depression following World War II. We no longer have that. So now people are at the end. They're stressed out. And they're, look, the Americans are the most depressed nation in the world already. They take more antidepressant drugs than anybody, plus the other kind of drugs that they're taking. You're going to see crime levels in America that are going to rival that of a third world country. Welcome Mexico City. You're going to start seeing people being kidnapped in this country like they do in other underdeveloping nations. So it's going to be very violent in America.
You're not exaggerating.
I'm not exaggerating. The facts are there. I have a saying. When people lose everything and they have nothing to lose, they lose it. You're going to see off with their heads. There's going to be another revolution in this country.
I hope to God that he is wrong. But something tells me he's not. That's Gerald Celente, U.S. trend forecaster of trendsresearch.com, with really bad news. And of course, you know, talking about all those retail spaces that are going empty. I see them just on a short bus ride downtown. People are going to squat in those. That's what's going to happen. Somehow, some way. I noted before I played the clip, and he may go into it in that interview, of course, you just heard a small bit, the idea of a tax revolt coming up very soon in this country. There is an article from freedomarizona.org, a tax revolt hits the U.S. in 2009 with a question mark. So it's on that note of dystopic future trends research that we're going to end the show with two looks back to a little bit of history, mystery, and of course, the work going on to expose the cover-ups and the deceptions to this very day. First, from archaeology.org, and under my own headline of Lusitania Truth, another war provocation exposed. And again, in a lot of these cases, whether we're talking about the Reichstag or Gulf of Tonkin or Pearl Harbor, we've known all along, it just takes a long time for it to basically become mainstream media known. And yes, Marinus van der Lubbe, the guy who was killed for supposedly burning down the Reichstag, he was recently exonerated. We all know the Nazis did it in a false flag terror event to seize power. Lusitania, of course, was the ship that went down that was one of the main impetus precipitations of getting the U.S. involved in World War I. Lusitania Truth, another war provocation exposed. The nearly century-old debate about whether the passenger liner Lusitania was transporting British war munitions when torpedoed by a German U-boat is over. The debate is over. Physical evidence of just such cargo has been recovered from the wreck, which rests 12 miles off the Irish coast in 300 feet of murky, turbulent water. Lusitania was sunk off County Cork on May 7th, 1915. The attack killed 1,198 people, including 128 Americans, and helped push the United States into World War I. Ever since the ship went down, there have been suspicions that Lusitania was carrying live munitions. Under the rules of war, that would have made the liner a legitimate target, as the Germans maintained at the time. The British government has always been evasive about the presence of munitions on the Lusitania. Two cargo manifests were submitted. The second, filed after the ship sailed, indicated there were light munitions on board. Some believe the ship was carrying much more, however, and that the British Navy attempted to destroy the wreck in the 1950s to conceal its military cargo. The article goes on, and it's in the new current issue, the January-February 2009 issue, Volume 62, Number 1 of Archaeology Today from archaeology.org. This article is by Aaron Mullally, and it's called Lusitania's Secret Cargo. Posted up, you can see the notice that was put in the New York Times by German authorities and diplomats. I don't have the name in front of me right now, but again, all the links are there for you. You can read all of the histories. And again, even thanks to 911blogger.com for hitting me with this. But you can see the notice put in the New York Times in advance telling Americans, hey guys, don't sail on this ship. We know that you're moving munitions. And that makes it a legitimate target. And we were, and they did, and it was another war provocation. Wars are based on deception. Pretty much always has been. That's our first history mystery note that, again, of course, reverberates to the very present. But another one that we have gone over a long time ago on MediaMonarchy.com was never on the radio show, and we'll get to those flashback links at the end. However, Geronimo's kin are still suing Skull and Bones over the remains. This from the Associated Press. Geronimo's descendants have sued Skull and Bones, the secret society at Yale University linked to presidents and other powerful figures, claiming that its members stole the remains of the legendary Apache leader decades ago and have kept them ever since. The federal lawsuit filed in Washington on Tuesday, the 100th anniversary of Geronimo's death, also names the university and the federal government. Geronimo's great-grandson, Harlan Geronimo, said his family believes Skull and Bone members took some of the remains in 1918 from a burial plot in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to keep in its New Haven clubhouse, the tomb. The alleged grave robbing is a long-standing legend that gained some validity in recent years with the discovery of a letter from a club member that described the theft. "I strongly believe from my heart that a spirit was never released," Harlan Geronimo said. Both Presidents Bush, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, and many others in powerful government and industry positions are members of the society, which is not affiliated with the university. After years of famously fighting the U.S. and Mexican armies, Geronimo and 35 warriors surrendered to General Nelson A. Miles near the Arizona-New Mexico border in 1886. Geronimo was eventually sent to Fort Sill and died at the Army outpost of pneumonia in 1909. According to lore, members of Skull and Bones, including former President George W. Bush's grandfather, Prescott Bush, dug up his grave when a group of Army volunteers from Yale were stationed at the fort during World War I, taking his skull and some of his bones. Harlan Geronimo, 61 years old now, wants those remains and any held by the federal government turned over to the family so they can be reburied near the Indian leader's birthplace in southern New Mexico's Gila Wilderness. Their lawsuit also names President Barack Obama, Defense Secretary Robert Gates, and Army Secretary Pete Garin as defendants. "I want them to understand we mean business. We're very serious. We're tired of waiting, and we're coming after them," said Harlan Geronimo. Neither members of Skull and Bones, who closely guard their secrecy, nor the Russell Trust Association, the organization's business shell for tax purposes, could of course not be reached for comment, as Geronimo's kin are still suing Skull and Bones over the remains.
Members of Geronimo's family want to dig up the past, literally. Descendants of the legendary Apache chief say his bones are hidden inside the clubhouse of Yale University's famously secret Skull and Bone Society. And now they're suing to get them back. Fox 61's Lori Perez joins us with more on their quest for his remains. Lori?
Erica, secrets, Indian legends, and more than one presidential connection are now colliding in this lawsuit filed on the 100th anniversary of Geronimo's death. It names, among others, President Barack Obama as a defendant. Geronimo's family clearly is serious about their claims that some of his remains are in New Haven, but some historians remain skeptical. The super elite, super covert Skull and Bone Society is housed inside this fortress-like building on High Street. What exactly happens inside isn't known to anyone who's not a member, though many have speculated.
They do all sorts of, I don't know, strange things in there that we don't know about. They have all sorts of money.
And Apache Chief Geronimo's family says they also have the remains of the legendary warrior. He died in 1909 near a military prison in Fort Sill, Oklahoma, and was buried there in the dress of a chief with his possessions. But in a lawsuit filed in U.S. District Court in Washington, D.C. this week, 19 members of his family are suing Yale University, the Skull and Bone Society, and the federal government, saying that in 1918 or 1919, members of the campus organization, including Prescott Bush, father of President George H.W. Bush and grandfather of President George W. Bush, opened the Oklahoma tomb of Geronimo and removed his skull, other bones, and items buried with the body and took them to the order's premises in New Haven.
The facts do not fit the stories that we hear over and over again.
2 years ago, when a letter surfaced saying the skull of the worthy Geronimo is now safe inside the tomb, we asked a historian about the repeated rumors that are now headed to federal court.
At the time, 1918, when Bush was here, the grave wasn't even marked. There was no vault, there was no crypt, there was no iron door. There was none of the above that are part of the legend of the Bush invasion of the grave.
Now, in the lawsuit, Geronimo's family says they want all of his remains returned so they can rebury them in his New Mexico homeland as he wished. And while they believe some of his remains are in New Haven, they claim the rest are still in Oklahoma. That's why they're suing the government. President Barack Obama is listed as a defendant because Geronimo was initially buried on a U.S. military base. I'm Lori Perez, Fox 61, News at 10.
Fleshing out Skull and Bones. You should, of course, read that book from Chris Milligan and his fantastic publishing house out of Oregon, Trine Day, Fleshing Out Skull and Bones. Geronimo's kin still suing Skull and Bones over remains. We can flash back all the way to May 2006 on MediaMonarchy.com. Quite a bit before the radio show ever started. Skeleton in the Bush family cupboard. And then from June 2007, did Bush's grandfather steal Geronimo's skull? Signs seem to point to yes. But that's where we're going to have to leave it for this episode 112 of MediaMonarchy.com. It's February 20th, 2009. Let's take a quick look at the creepy customers coming to MediaMonarchy.com in the past week. We had the ATTBCO Army Recreation Machine with an ISP out of West Point, New York. Now, whether or not this was the Army Recruitment Arcade that we covered that's in New Jersey, sounds familiar. But they had hit a link to MediaMonarchy.com from somewhere within an email. And they're, of course, reading about Beverly Eckert, 9/11 widow and activist among the 50 killed in the New York plane crash. Hearst Argyle Television Incorporated out of New York City. They were watching the video where the CNBC guest says that the Illuminati was behind the stock market crash. We played that clip for you recently. Kimberly Clark Corporation, Anderson, Indiana, Googled cloud seeding controversy. And, of course, not even posted up. I believe China is claiming success in snow with their cloud seeding blasts that have been going on lately. We covered all that before the Olympics in their massive effort to clean everything up. Gannett Company, which is a news media company, they own the ElPasoTimes.com, which we noted on a previous episode about basically Texas preparing for the possible collapse of Mexico's government and what they'll do when tens of thousands of people flee north. And of course, they're setting up and passing H.R. 645, the National Emergency Centers Act, to be able to detain mass amounts of people for whatever reason. So somebody at ElPasoTimes.com landed on MediaMonarchy.com after Googling Juarez border plus drugs, plus CIA, plus Condor. And it makes me quite happy to think that a reporter at the El Paso Times is looking into drug running and the CIA and Operation Condor that even dates back to overthrowing governments. And again, it ties in with the drug money and the drug war that we covered. Narco-terror, BCCI, Iran-Contra, propping up banks to this very day, Alan Stanford. So, good on you, somebody at El Paso Times. Keep digging into all of that. Juarez border, plus drugs, plus CIA, plus Condor. We had the U.S. Department of Transportation out of D.C. ICE abandons its self-deportation program for illegals, which we went over several months ago. Somebody at Rockstar Games, makers of your favorite mind-numbing video games, Piscataway, New Jersey. They were checking out the 9/11 preview, and that was the Pakistani airline ad from 1979 that shows a plane seeming to crash into the World Trade Center towers. Again, the House of Representatives out of Manassas, Virginia, the New Jersey Department of Transportation, they Googled Jonathan Bayless. We, of course, had Fort Bliss from the Army, reading about special ops forces conducting activities on U.S. soil. Hollywood Entertainment out of Lake Oswego, Oregon, reading about U.S. military offering the path to citizenship, which we just went over today. Presidential Office Computer Department from the Islamic Republic of Iran, they were reading about several months ago when NORAD released the motherload of 9/11 tapes. George Mason University, reading about Bush okaying the grants to preserve the Japanese internment camps. We had someone from MCHSI.com Google people hanging out windows of Twin Towers 9/11. And of course, you can see those photos and wonder, well, shit, if that fire is so hot, it's weakening the steel. How's that woman standing on it outside the building? But I digress. We had the Boeing Company out of Long Beach Google DARPA management changes Tether Obama. That's, of course, Tony Tether, the now ex-head of DARPA. who are we going to get to head the new Mad Science Military Department? The California Department of Corrections out of Sacramento, California, Googled Robin DeRute, and I forget what that's about. The Mayo Foundation out of Rochester, reading about H.R. 645 and Alcee Hastings in the National Emergency Centers Act. And finally, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, out of Gaithersburg, Maryland. We're reading from my link on whatreallyhappened.com about the death, the mysterious death, of 9/11 World Trade Center 7 eyewitness Barry Jennings. I seem to have lost my voice at the very end, and that's appropriate because that is the end, my friends. Thanks for helping me out on this. Keep spreading the word. Keep getting in contact with me, and I'll keep doing it. My name's James Evan Pilato. I'm your host and webmaster of MediaMonarchy.com. Like my man Webster Tarpley says, get active or get radioactive. Take care.
Police would get him just the same.